Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps oral argument on the case Seven County Infrastructure Coalition versus Eagle County, Colorado. Speaking on the panel today, we have Professor Andrew Mergen of Harvard Law School and Professor Paul Salamanca of the University of Kentucky College of Law. And we're joined by Eric Grant, a partner at Hicks Thomas, who will be moderating the discussion today. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Eric, thanks for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Edith, for that introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. Let's get right to it. As Edith mentioned, our panelists today are Professor Andrew Mergen of Harvard Law School and Interim Dean and Professor Paul Salamanca of the University of Kentucky College of Law. But since they're my friends, I'm going to call them Andy and Paul today. I had the pleasure of serving with both Andy and Paul in the Environment and Natural Resources Division of the U.S. Department of Justice from 2017 to 2021. And for those of you with repressed memories, that was the first Trump administration. All of us litigated NEPA cases like the case under discussion today. Paul and I were just a passing through as political appointees, but Andy spent some three decades in the appellate section of the Environment Division, beginning as a summer intern and retiring as chief. I would venture to say that he's litigated more NEPA cases than any human being, alive or dead. And I'm confident that he would have been an excellent advocate for the government or for either of the other parties in yesterday's oral argument. And that argument, of course, is our subject today, together with prognostications and implications. For those, we'll hear first from Andy. Take it away, Professor.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. It's great to be here with you and Paul. The case that I did do a lot of NEPA work in my 33 years at DOJ, and I'm really interested in this. This case arises in a particular context. As we know, NEPA is the most litigated environmental statute. I think Paul Clement, on behalf of the petitioners, made that point at oral argument yesterday. Notwithstanding the frequency in which NEPA is in the courts, it makes only irregular appearances on the court's docket. Probably the most significant NEPA case prior to this one was probably in 20 years ago in the public citizen case, which I'm sure we'll end up talking something about. I think the Seven Counties case, which is just to quickly refresh about the approval by the Surface Transportation Board, an independent executive agency that approves new rail lines. This case involves a rail line of about 88 miles, which is going to be used to transport crude oil, connect it to other major rails for transmission to refinement. And the issue here is whether the scope, one of the issues and the issue before the court relates to the scope of the environmental impact statement prepared by STB for this rail line and whether it was adequate. And the environmental groups in Eagle County in Colorado allege that it fails for both a failure to consider certain upstream effects related to the development of oil fields in the Uinta Basin and downstream effects largely related to refineries, ultimate refinery of this oil, either in Puget Sound or in the Gulf Coast of the U.S. And it comes to the court at a very particular moment and an important moment in the history of this, you know, profoundly important statute, a statute that is litigated a ton, has influenced the way other countries and other states approach environmental disclosures, how international banks like the World Bank, Asian Development Bank require environmental disclosures. ZNEPA is a look before you leap statute. And I think everyone sort of understands the utility of, before you're making a ground disturbing activity, before you're undertaking some sort of profound action, that you should think about it. And Congress told the agencies to think about it and the environmental effects. As the point was well made by Paul Clement yesterday on behalf of petitioners, it is a procedural, not substantive statute. The purposes of the statute are served when both the decision maker and the public are informed about the environmental effects. And as I just do want to situate it in this particular moment in environmental law, where there is concern by many that climate change poses a catastrophic threat, that we need to move at an accelerated pace to electrification and away from fossil fuels. And that has created a certain synergy on people both on the left and the right to cause people to rethink whether NEPA is overly cumbersome, impedes important infrastructure and public works, whether it's this rail line, which is important to the Ute tribe and to these counties in Utah, or to the development of offshore wind in Massachusetts, where I'm sitting right now. So there's a lot of concern about the statute, and Congress has been active within the last year or so, and in currently active about sort of rethinking where we should take it. I think the turning to the actual merits of this case, I think the ultimate dispute is, has NEPA really expanded well beyond all sort of reasonable limits, and does it need to be constrained? And the submission by the petitioners is that it very much does, that it's become too cumbersome, but it has become, it encompasses too much analysis. And their solution largely relates to two submissions. One, that it should take a lot of lessons from tort law related to proximate causation, and two, that it should be cabined sort of temporally and spatially. And the government stakes out a somewhat different position, as sort of a more contextual analysis built around foreseeability and what is foreseeable and how you should deal with foreseeability. Also, of course, informed by what power the agency has to address these sorts of things. And the environmental group in Eagles County really focus on foreseeability and allege that the things that should have been analyzed here submissions in their beliefs are really foreseeable that there'll be more refinement of this oil, that it will impact communities in the Gulf Coast, and that there will be upstream effects with the further development out of these oil fields in the Uinta Basin, and that they should have been considered. And I'll just stop and sort of say that the government likes to be in the middle. That's a good place. So it's a very comfortable place for me in my many years at DOJ, and I'm speaking only in my personal capacity and here. And I think the government has it sort of exactly right in terms of these are highly contextual analyses. There are lessons we can draw from tort law, but tort law itself is an inferior tool and not the appropriate tool for this. And that there are limits to sort of foreseeability as well, and you draw on those limits from a particular context. And I think the government did a robust defense of SDP's analysis without going as far as the petitioners. And I think that's exactly right. And I'll just stop to make one further comment. I think there is no doubt that the STB's decision is affirmed at the end of the day. Listening to the argument, I did not hear the environmental groups in Eagle County drawing on a lot of support. I think the real question is, how does the court write the opinion affirming STB's analysis? And my submission is that they should write narrowly, and that they should write narrowly informed by all of our respect for the separation of powers, knowing that Congress is very much involved in this and may go in its own direction. I think we do expect some legislation on permitting reform. And so I would submit that the court shouldn't have taken the case in the first place, which was also an argument made by the respondents. But having taken the court, I think better that they not write some grand test, but instead double down on deference to the agencies in this analysis. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Andy. I think you identified what one of our other former DOJ colleagues called the Goldilocks position, the government perfectly in the middle. Thank you for those remarks. I'll turn it over to Paul.
You're on
Paul, mute. Who's on mute. Wouldn't be a true Zoom meeting without at least one person on mute. Right.
Am I now live? It's nice to be on a program with my old friends, Andy Murrigan and Eric Grant. It was a pleasure to work with the two of you at the Department of Justice a few years ago. Let me start out, back up from this all. NEPA's an unusual statute. I don't want to say that there's nothing like it, but there aren't many statutes like NEPA. It requires agencies to gather information that they are then free to ignore. And so it gives rise to what could reasonably be described as a beauty contest. The ultimate question is whether the agency has conducted a sufficiently specific and thorough analysis such that in the eyes of the reviewing court, it's asked all the right questions, even if it then came to the conclusion that it wanted to ignore everything it found out. That's, to be candid, a little bit weird. For the most part, in the legal system, we have rules. The rules are relatively determined, let's say. We have standards of liability. We have consequences that can be discerned. Of course, we depart from those ideals. Let's start with, for example, the world of negligence. We have the United States versus Carroll Towing case. We have a theory about comparing benefits and burdens and when you should take precautions. Of course, in the real world, we depart enormously from the Carroll Towing test, but at least we have the test as a comparator. There is no comparator in NEPA. NEPA is ultimately in the eyes of the beholder, which means that in any piece of litigation, you're ultimately dependent on the cleverness of the attorneys and the panel you get and the circuit where you find yourself. And really, that's a prescription for disaster. I can't imagine why any rational legislature would set up a beauty contest and subject the nation's infrastructure or any nation's infrastructure to a beauty contest. So I start with the premise that it's sort of the contrapositive or a sideways look at this. There's an old saying, anything worth doing should be worth doing well. Because NEPA is a little bit of a conceptual disaster. It needs to be cabined, I would say. And let's face it. NEPA has almost no operative rules inside of it. As a matter of fact, all it really says to agencies is compile a detailed statement of the effects of your contemplated activities. That's it. I mean, everything else is grandiose and sounds great, but that's really the operative principle that animates NEPA. Everything else is, you might say, either an administrative or a judicial oak that grew out of a legislative acorn. That's a line that Justice Rehnquist used in a 34 Act case. All of the rules that CEQ has come up with since the 1970s obviously are an administrative function, assuming they have any validity at all, assuming CEQ has any authority whatsoever to promulgate rules. And then the judiciary has created, and I recognize that the APA obviously gives a hook in here, but the judiciary has allowed this area of litigation, frankly, to metastasize. As Justice Rehnquist said in the case that I was just referring to, it's a 34 Act case, but blue chip stamps versus Manor Drug Stores. If you have a judicial oak that's grown out of a legislative acorn, it's becoming to the court to be mindful of how it's metastasized and to take steps as a rule of reason might dictate to trim the judicial oak. And one great way to trim the judicial oak was identified by Justice Thomas in Public Citizen, which is a case that Andy adverted to briefly in his opening remarks. In Public Citizen, the court held that an agency need not evaluate effects for which it is not the legally relevant cause. And I suspect that Andy himself would concede that seven county infrastructure was about what the court meant by that, what it meant by legally relevant cause. I would propose that legally relevant cause should be limited to any effects that are within the organic jurisdiction of the agency or derivative of the organic jurisdiction of the agency. And so in Public Citizen itself, it was about whether what would happen if Mexican trucks were allowed to operate in the United States. And the administrative agency said, well, if Mexican trucks were allowed to operate in the United States, there'd be roadside inspections that may give rise to some accidents. While the vehicle's idle, there'd be emissions, there'd be noise while the vehicles are idling. Those things were either squarely within the remit of the agency or immediately derivative of what the agency was doing. The agency was going to pull over trucks and inspect them. And while they were being pulled over, they were going to idle, which gives rise to emissions. They were going to make noise. And because they're in the breakdown lane, they might cause accidents. They didn't go beyond that, and the court said they didn't have to go beyond that. Similarly, in this case, we're talking about an 88-mile railroad. So to build an 88-mile railroad and operate an 88-mile railroad, you're going to have a certain amount of cutting and filling. When you have to go over a gully, you're going to have to fill it in. You're going to have a culvert so the water has somewhere to go. And when you're going through a little hill, you're going to have some cutting. Then when you're actually operating the railroad, you're going to have some emissions. You might have some, if it's an old-fashioned locomotive with a spark box, you might have sparks and wildfires. You might hit a deer every now and then. Those are certainly things that are immediately derivative of authorizing an 88-mile railroad to operate. But what the D.C. Circuit said to STB, what the court said it should have done was that it should have analyzed not only the 88 miles of railroad and the cutting and filling to build the railroad, but also it should have taken into account the likelihood that wells would be drilled in the basin that Andy was referring to because of improvements in the transportation system, and also that the waxy crude oil generated in the basin would be taken somewhere, Port Arthur, Texas, or Shreveport, or Puget Sound, and refined, and would then have effects on those communities and so on. Those activities are obviously outside the remit of the STB. The STB has no authority over refining in Texas. It has no authority even over what happens on the main railroad lines. It only has authority to approve. Its authority is relative, is a little bit larger than I'm indicating. But with respect to this, it only has authority to approve the 88-mile railroad. So I think Public Citizen really speaks to this case and says that the legally relevant cause of the effects in Port Arthur, Texas, or even in the basin is not STB. My objection to the trajectory of the argument yesterday is that Paul Clements, who represents Seven County, to put it in athletic terms, he's Bill Belichick. He wants to win by one point. I get that. If I had a client the way he had a client, I too would want to be happy to win by one point. And so he proposed a test where if an effect is, number one, outside an agency's organic jurisdiction, and number two, it's a conjunctive test, remote in time or place from the agents from the proposed activity, then the agency need not study it. That leaves such decisions as Sable Trail relatively safe. And frankly, Ed Needler and Paul Clement both expressed sort of ambivalence on whether Sable Trail was correctly decided or wasn't correctly decided. But I think Sable Trail was incorrectly decided because in Sable Trail, FERC was compelled to evaluate the emissions effects of natural gas that would be combusted in plants, even though FERC had no authority over the plants themselves. It only had authority over natural gas pipelines. So I think that the test that Paul Clement proposed would work for his client, probably. And let me emphasize that adverb, probably. I think it would work. I'm not sure it would work. And here's why I'm not sure it would work. Certainly, it would excuse STB from analyzing the effects at refineries in Port Arthur, Texas. That's certainly remote in time and place. I'm not so sure about on the upline side of things. If there was a well a mile away from the top of the railroad, I'm not sure that the respondents in this case couldn't make a credible argument that that's not remote in time and place from the railway. In any case, what's going to happen here, I agree with Andy, the Supreme Court's going to reverse. The D.C. Circuit's going to remand to the STB, and we're not done. If what we want in a sane world of environmental regulation is a little bit of predictability and the ability with people, for investors, to have some certainty as to what's going to happen, this case really doesn't move the needle forward with the test that Paul Clement proposes. So I hope that the court, if it accepts Paul Clement's test, understands his phrase remote in time and place to include as well some sort of a notion of conceptual remoteness, so that what the STB is in charge of, which is the permitting of a railroad to operate, whatever is immediately derivative of that process, you could consider that conceptually not remote. But something that's conceptually distinct, I think that's something that NEPA shouldn't require the agency to evaluate. And I think that it just creates the kinds of problems that NEPA has been associated with. I think the government's test is worse in the sense that the government's test doesn't really alleviate any of the uncertainty that plagues NEPA. The government essentially said, all the tests we have are fine. They were just misapplied by the D.C. Circuit, you know, application of settled law to the facts. Well, that doesn't really help anybody, I don't think. If what we need in this area is a little bit of certainty so we can encourage investments, we're not going to get it from the government's test. I know I sound a lot more critical of the case than Andy was gentle, but I'll yield.
Thank you, Paul. There's a lot there. Andy, you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, as always, I find myself in agreement with some of what Paul says and in disagreement with some of what Paul says. And I think our job in life is to, you know, see where we can build on our agreements. And I want to first start with that. I agree. I heard Paul to sort of say, and I'll, you know, of course, you can tell me if I'm getting this wrong, but your discussion about beauty contests and judges, I think I strongly agree that the courts have played an outsized and inappropriate role in sort of NEPA. And I think that is actually maybe a feature and not a bug. I mean, I think if you go back to one of the early NEPA cases that has certainly grown in some prominence recently, Sierra Club versus CLEPI, there's a really interesting point that Justice Marshall, Thurgood Marshall, makes in his concurrence. And he says, you know, I think Justice Marshall agrees with a lot of what Paul said. And what Marshall says is like, God, the statute, there's not a lot of text here really to work with at all. And it seems like just an invitation for courts to go sort of, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but to go wild with sort of common law. It's a common law statute, and that courts are going to tell us what they think. And that is going to drive the development of the statute. And I think that's right. I mean, CEQ didn't change the regs for a really long time. I think the point was made at argument that the initial go-round of what CEQ thought was that these documents were going to be modest in scope and not very long. And then the CEQ regs, which were promulgated when I was in high school, which was a super long time ago, stayed on the books for a really, really long time. And, you know, the problem with that is that things change, right? And life gets more complicated and litigation gets more sophisticated. And the courts are constantly filling in the gap, right? That is what's happening. And so, you know, Clement, Paul is a very good advocate, and he, you know, he gets in his points. He's like, the D.C. Circuit and the Ninth Circuit have gone too far here. And I think certainly in the government, being a government lawyer for a long time, we often felt like the Ninth Circuit was more interested in what the challengers had to say than what the government had to say about how the statute should be administered. So I agree. I think Paul and I agree on a lot of that. What we don't agree on is the solution, because I think importing these tort concepts, these proximate cause concepts, et cetera, just double down on a judicial role that is really inappropriate and it does not clarify anything. And the reason it wouldn't clarify anything is because tort rules address a different issue. If I run you over with a car, the courts look at liability, they look at blame, they do all of those assessments. That's not the job of NEPA. NEPA is a look before you leap statute. It is intended to inform decision makers. It is intended to inform the public. And I think, you know, there's a comment, I think even Justice Kavanaugh made this point. I think this point, and I know you're going to ask us about the argument in the transcript, Eric, but I think this point was made several points along the way by maybe Barrett, by Kavanaugh and others, that maybe what really the court needs to do here is to double down on the good judgment of the agencies who have to administer this. They're the people who are most well situated to sort of say, what is foreseeable? What makes sense in this context? And, you know, I know that that's unpopular. I know that that Paul, who said to Paul is a good New Englander, and he looks to Bill Belichick with some criticism because New England fans are never satisfied, but says, you know, don't win by one point. And Paul very much indicated that he wouldn't be happy, but he would certainly settle for winning by one point. And he said, you know, he himself made the deference point. And there's a little irony because he recently told the court not to pay any attention to deference. But here's the thing, right? As between judges administering the statute and the agencies who are well situated to make these judgments and I think do a good job. And in that regard, I want to say something that, like, there's a lot of talk about NEPA, but there's very few people doing sort of empirical work in terms of how it plays out, which is a shame. And I would shout out to David Adelman, a professor at the University of Texas, who has looked at sort of NEPA results and whether NEPA is an impediment to projects and infrastructure. And I think the numbers say that there are a lot of myths about NEPA and, you know, it's creating all of these downsides that just don't exist. So I think, like, the agencies are mostly getting it right. And I would further say that Paul's construction, I think, with all due respect, Dean Salamanca, I think the problem is that it's atextual. I mean, the text itself contemplates that agencies are going to consider things outside of their organic remit, that agencies are going to consult with other agencies. As you know, all EISs go to EPA under Section 309 of the Clean Air Act, whether or not it's an EPA issue or not. There's a sort of, like, I mean, President Biden would say a one government approach, and President Trump might say a unitary executive approach. But the idea is that you're not held up in your analysis just because you're BLM. You don't regulate the flaring from the oil and gas operation on a BLM land, but for sure you're going to inform the public about that flaring. You know, that is longstanding NEPA practice and sort of, I think, very workable at the end of the day. I think the emissions are very workable. I think the environmental groups get very, very concerned about how much greenhouse gases are being emitted. But by and large, that work can be done. And in Sable Trail, you know, that pipeline was going to specific plants, so easy to figure out what those emissions were. And I think in a very common sense, foreseeable way, that case actually makes a lot of sense at the end of the day. I knew I had another point, but I've totally forgotten it. And I guess I would just close by saying, let's all agree that I think Paul and I can agree that the one problem is judges. And we're respectfully, I don't want any judges to yell at me, but respectfully, one problem is judges. And two, that maybe I can persuade Paul that the text matters here. And so I wouldn't look to what the court said in Public Citizen. I would turn straight to the statute. The statute is thin, but it certainly contemplates consultation outside of sort of the organic remit of the particular agency doing the analysis. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Andy. You doubly recommended doubling down on deference. And I think that was indeed the theme of Ed Kneedler's argument. He started out seeking a, quote, broad amount of discretion, unquote, for the agencies. I guess what struck me about that kind of argument is it seems not so much unreasonable, but anachronistic in light of the developments in the court last term and how this court is treating deference to agencies and treating it with skepticism. So, Paul, do you want to address that point or anything else that he said?
I'd love to. And I think Andy's right. He and I probably agree more than we disagree. I think we obviously disagree on the execution of a particularly important principle, but we agree on the principle, which is that it's a framework that perhaps frustrates more than it provides, costs more than it provides value as it's currently deployed. And you might not put it that way, Andy, but it needs attention, as I guess what you're saying. I do support a bright line rule, and I hear you saying that the bright line rule has costs. And let me concede that a bright line rule has costs. So obviously, saying that you're not responsible for things outside your remit is a bright line rule. The virtue of a bright line rule is that it's easily administered. Agencies tend to know, not completely, but they tend to know fairly well what their remit is. It's in the statute. They can see what they're responsible for, and they can plan in terms of that. And in the Mexican Trucks case gives an example of what that might entail, and I set forth what that might entail in this situation, and it's a bright line rule. So that's the virtue is it's predictable. You know what you have to do. You're not as vulnerable to fly specking. The cost is that you might miss something. And if you want to think of NEPA as this prophylactic statute that makes sure that we never miss anything, no matter where it happens, as long as it's foreseeable, then that's a cost. And I'll grant you that. So the question is, which is greater, the benefit of the bright line rule or the cost? And I think the benefit of the bright line rule exceeds the cost. Because we need to get this country moving. And you gave some examples in your top remarks, Andy, both in the oil patch and in new renewable sources of energy. We need to facilitate long and skinny infrastructure, particularly ways of getting energy from where it's generated to where it's used. So I think that's my defense of it. And you made a great argument about the textual nature of it, to which I have two responses. One is that even the plain meaning can be ignored when it's absurd. And I think no rational legislature would want to make its infrastructure subject to a beauty contest. But apart from that, the operative language of NEPA is actually very spare. You know, you have to do this study. There is a duty of consultation, which I might get a chance to talk about. I don't want to use up too much time. But it's fairly light. What the operative scope of NEPA actually is. And it's largely the courts and CEQ that have decided what becomes of that. And once that's true, then a rule of reason applies. And if a rule of reason applies, and the Supreme Court has said that in the context of NEPA, I think adopting a bright line rule whose benefits exceed its costs is justified. And I'm not sure if I actually answered the question you asked, Eric. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's the nature of these things. I have to confess, I learned a new word, remit, as a synonym for jurisdiction. That seems to be the word du jour, both today and at argument yesterday. One thing that struck me about argument in that regard was nobody seemed quite sure whether the STB actually had the remit to consider environmental effects and whether STB could say, well, this meets all the criteria under the Interstate Commerce Act or whatever statute it now administers. But nonetheless, we've seen enough of the deleterious environmental effects that we're just not going to approve it anyway. And that question seemed to be lurking out there unanswered. And I wonder if either of you saw the same thing and has an answer.
This is out of order, Andy. May I speak first? Is that okay? Two responses to that. One is it basically makes this case Mexican trucks again. Essentially says, because you have no option, STB, but to approve this, in which case you'd only be the but-for cause of the environmental effects, you have no choice. You have to approve this. In other words, it's on all four legs with Mexican trucks. The other problem I see with that, in which case it doesn't accomplish much, the other problem I see with that is that it strikes me as a category mistake. The decision whether to accept all carriage because you're a common carrier is not actually STB's, it's the railroads. And I'm not sure that it's metaphysically appropriate to transfer from the railroad to the STB that particular decision and say, because the railroad has no choice, therefore the STB has no choice on. So I think that the logic of that argument doesn't really work. I also think that if that's all that happens, again, you have this Belichick victory for the railroad, fine, but I'd like to see more.
Andy?
Yeah, I had the same feeling about the argument that question was out there lurking, and I didn't really hear an answer. And I suspect the answer is complicated. I think there could be a legal answer, and I will admit that I don't know the answer. There's also a practical answer, which is that I think the briefs make the point that I think the government's brief says this, if I remember from reading it again this morning, you know, that there's a presumption that STB is going to approve these rail uses. I mean, just like, you know, these acts that undergird these agencies are intended to promote commerce. That's what Congress had in mind when, you know, it told STB to make these decisions. I used to do a lot of work with FAA, which also is having a moment. And, you know, the FAA Act also is like FAA's job in part is to promote air commerce, right? So for an agency whose mission is sort of related to commerce to sort of say no is a heavy lift. Even if it has the authority to say no. But I think I will say I agree with Paul that in some ways, I think this is what you're saying. I think that issue is something of a distraction in a way, because one thing that Paul Clement stated a lot is that, you know, the investment of his clients in mitigation and things like that. And I can't say that the only relevance of these disclosures relates to whether or not the agency can say thumbs up or thumbs down. In fact, as a result of the NEPA process, countless projects are redesigned in a way that avoid stupid, ill-intentioned, unnecessary harms to the environment. I wish we had a better empirical database to draw on. I think that CEQ has traditionally been sort of underfunded. So I can only speak from my experience, which is, you know, 30 years of doing NEPA. I've seen a lot of things improved by virtue of these sorts of disclosures. And I think, you know, I think that at the end of the day, the STB's decision falls well within the rule of reason. But in terms of upstream effects, I feel like the environmental groups have a very strong case to be made to make that maybe the agency could have done more. And whether the agency could have said yes or no, maybe there are things associated with mitigation, with fire risk, with all of these other things, with the possible pollution associated with this that could have been mitigated through this process. So I agree with you, Eric. Absolutely. The question was looming there. But in some ways, I think my view in terms of how NEPA works, and I deem the statute very successful. I do not think that any sort of weighing favors the test that Paul is proposing over the status quo, because I think the status quo mostly works and we can all pick and choose. You know, I think environmentalists would say, what about, you know, Cape Wind, which was, you know, dragged through the courts so that this renewable project went forward. And, you know, people who are more focused on extractive can say Sable Trail, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is that these are a handful of things, and mostly the statute, I think. And I say this as somebody who did it for a long time, works pretty well. And that's why it is the most copied, emulated environmental statute of all time, because it has, the way it works, has real value. And I'll get off my soapbox, Eric.
So your remarks reminded me of a statement by counsel for respondent yesterday. NEPA requires agencies to look at even harms that they cannot mitigate and harms that they do not regulate directly. And it sounds like you agree with that, but that seems especially contrary to your test, Paul. That's kind of outside their jurisdiction, and there should be a bright line cutting that off.
I do think that. Yes, I do. And I think Andy has isolated the point on which the two of us disagree. And I'm emphasizing or defending the value of a bright line rule. And not seeing NEPA as a prophylactic statute where an agency is just responsible for anything that's foreseeable or anything that's foreseeable within some contextual realm, which is the way the United States put it. I think that it's essentially tea-leaved, if you let me make up a verb there, in public citizen, in the concept of legally relevant cause. Yes. So.
All right. To be faithful to questioners, to show that we do read the questions, I'll ask you guys this. Neither of you has really talked much about foreseeability and proximate cause and what might be the right test here. Questioner asks, does legally relevant cause narrow relevance in contrast to, say, logically relevant or scientifically relevant? So I'll use that as a springboard to ask you guys, you can answer that specific question, or the more general question is causation, foreseeability, is that going to figure in the decision, or is that kind of a sideshow here?
Andy?
Well, you know, the statute was amended recently to specifically use, I think the phrase is reasonable foreseeability, right? So once again, you know, Congress informed by this heady debate about its role and its need to be precise in its language gave us some terms that are crystal clear in their meaning and that we can all agree using the traditional tools of statutory construction what reasonably foreseeable means. So it was a gift. I mean, being sarcastic, what does reasonable foreseeability mean? But I think that's again where, if it's just not knowable, whether this stuff is going to Puget Sound or whether it's going to Port Arthur or it's going to Shreveport, then it's just not reasonably foreseeable. And, you know, I felt as a government lawyer, you know, it was said that Rome, and I think about Rome, it was said that Rome never lost a war because they never stopped fighting. But I believe, like, you know, there should be an ending point, and that's the reasonableness. That's the rule of reason. And so I think there's a lot to be said for the notion that if you can't really say how this crude's going to be, this waxy crude's going to be refined and where it's going, that's the end of the inquiry. But if you know in Sable Trail, which I somebody can fact check me, and so I've, please forgive me if I'm wrong, I think it was pretty clear exactly where that gas was going, right? Crystal clear. So easy to figure out like what the effects of burning were going to be, because you knew exactly where it was going to go. And so all I can do is say that that's sort of, I think the right test is reasonableness. That's the statutory term. And as the government said, it sort of depends on context and what information we have. And unfortunately, like, I think it's not a clear test, but we know what the factors are, right? Do we have to guess? Is it speculative? And if it's speculative, then it's not reasonably foreseeable, and we can stop there. And I do expect the court to touch on this issue, because I, like Justice Kagan and many others, believe we're all textualists now.
Well, if you think about Rome that much, Andy, there might be a place for you in the next administrations. Paul, anything to add about foreseeability or causation or?
Yes. So we're all lawyers on this call, and we understand how the legal system works. If you have a client who wants to accomplish a particular thing, and there are ways that the client might be able to accomplish that thing, then the client's, depending on motivation and funding, the client's going to try. And so if you use words that aren't really determined, like, you know, foreseeable, phrases like reasonably foreseeable, if you use phrases like that, which is what the government is proposing in its brief in this matter, if you talk about contextual analysis and then you map that onto the CEQ rules as complex as they are, you provide an enormous number of targets for people who oppose projects, and you essentially facilitate opposition to anything. And so you end up in the beauty contest that I was describing earlier. And I just ask whether we want to subject our entire infrastructure, both at the green end of things and at the oil patch end of things, to that kind of litigation, or whether that's a recipe for a failed state. I propose more bright line rules consistent with the rule of reason. If we were to work in the world of torts, I would strongly suggest that we investigate the concepts of intervening and superseding cause, which gets at this is outside the remit of this particular administrative agency, and yet it's a principle that comes out of the world of torts. If we're going to start inviting the world of torts into the world of NEPA, then I can't see why we don't bring that in as well, which catches up with the test that I'm proposing.
So both of you, if I recall correctly, predict a reversal and a acceptance of this particular environmental document by the Surface Transportation Board. Paul, do you think the court is going to go farther? It struck me. One of Paul Clement's statements was, if you restated public citizen, reaffirmed the rule of reason, reemphasized arbitrary and capricious review, and reminded the D.C. Circuit that the APA itself builds in harmless error review, you might make the world a better place. Do you think the world would be a better place with that, even without your test?
Yes. Yes. That would be Bill Belichick.
Okay. Andy, any final thoughts, any final predictions, I guess, on how the court resolves the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think the trick is like who's going to write, right? Because I think that I heard some votes for a narrow opinion. I think that was true of Kagan. I think it was true of Jackson. I think it was true of Sotomayor. I got a maybe a hint of it from Kavanaugh and maybe a hint of it from Barrett. So and I'll just say I'm going to make a plug for a narrow opinion here, because this is not an area in which Congress is has its head in the sand like an ostrich. The Congress is acutely aware of the fomentation around NEPA. And so I would prefer putting on my separation of powers hat that the hard choices were made by Congress. The only prediction that I will make is that I will be unhappy with what Congress does. But putting that aside,
Congress or the court?
Congress. But putting that aside, I think those are the right people to decide these issues. And going back to Paul's arguments previously, I think part of the why NEPA is subject of so much debate is because the courts have had an outsized role in its development for a long time. CEQ didn't really do much for a long time. I think they're doing much better now. And I think Congress has sort of ignored it for a super long time. And between the courts and the executive branch or Congress, I'm always going to lean towards the Democratic branch. Even though I know that, the triumph of hope over experience, I know they will break my heart some way, but I think they're the right people to do it. I think the court shouldn't have granted cert here. And I think I feel like they're going to reverse, and they should do it in a narrow way so that Congress can operate on a open canvas and not a constrained canvas.
What about Sable Trail? Is it going to come in for attention in this opinion or not?
I think it'll definitely make an appearance, but I hope it doesn't make an appearance in the majority. I think the case my submission to you is that this is a harder case than Sable Trail, that Sable Trail is maybe an easier case. But I recognize that reasonable minds can definitely disagree on that.
Didn't you defend the government in Sable Trail?
Sable Trail is a FERC case.
Ah, right. Okay. I'm sorry.
So it goes back to our unitary executive.
Very good. Well, we're coming close to the end. Paul, I'll give you sort of final thoughts opportunity here.
Well, I think we haven't mentioned yet the fact that Justice Gorsuch recused himself last week from this oral argument. I think that might have affected the nature of the case. If I were in Paul Clement's shoes, when I read that, I might have changed my approach, because I'd start thinking, and going to Andy's point, who's going to write this? I'm hopeful, speaking for myself. And let me say, I have a client here. I wrote an amicus brief for the Center for Environmental Accountability. My hope is that Justice Thomas writes the opinion, and Justice Thomas writes the opinion saying, this is what we meant in Public Citizen and essentially pursuing the approach that I've advocated. Given what happened on the bench, and I think this is what Andy and you was adverting to, and you were too, Eric, I'm not sure what's going to happen now. I still hope that Justice Thomas does it, but it might be a more modest and narrow opinion with Justice Thomas writing separately.
And take from one of the questions from the audience, does the STB's document get approved here in the Supreme Court, or is STB going to have to look at this again one way or another?
I think so.
Yeah. We know that, like, you know, one of the points that the government made in its brief in opposition, right, is that you know, a win here on these issues. And there's a lot of debate about what the scope of the between the cert petition and the brief on the merits, there was a shift. And how big a shift, I guess, remains in debate. But there's definitely work to be done, right? This rail line does not move forward after a win in the Supreme Court, just like, you know, after Loper Bright, the issue of observers wasn't settled, right? That a remand that was just recently argued again in the D.C. Circuit. So I'm not sure what the questioner is exactly getting at, but there's still a lot of work to be done here, even if the petitioners and the government prevails.
That sounds like a win in a sense for the opponents of the project, regardless of the benefits to future project proponents.
Yeah, Marshall McLuhan said it all, right? The medium is the message. If you can litigate for years and neither slow down or stop a project, you win even if you lose.
Well, I think we've come to the end, unless either of you has any pithy final remarks. I want to thank both of you for your very perceptive contributions. I've enjoyed moderating this, and unless you jump in, I'm going to turn it over to Edith. Very good. Thanks again. Edith?
Yes, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professors Mergen and Salamanca for speaking with us and to Eric for moderating today. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We're really grateful for your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.